Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from across Ukraine. Detailed developments in diplomacy as NATO moves to Trump-proof support for Ukraine. And we hear about an innovative project to help veterans deal with PTSD and reintegrate in society from the charity Ukrainian Action.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody is going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of April, 2 years and 39 days since the full-scale invasion began. Today, I'm joined by our assistant comment editor, Francis Durnley, foreign correspondent, James Kilner, and our guests are Natasha and Jeffrey Hartman from the charity Ukrainian Action. I started by summarising the latest updates from Ukraine. Russian missile strikes on a school in Dnipro yesterday left 18 people injured, including 5 children. This comes from the regional governor. Quote, Russians committed a crime against the most precious children. They gutted a kindergarten in Dnipro and also college. This is from Sahil Isak, who posted on Telegram. Up to the north in Kharkiv, a 58-year-old man was killed and his 11-year-old son later died in hospital after Russia shelled a village in Kupiansk. Further north in Sumy, 226 explosions were reported over the past 24 hours as Russia struck 11 communities in 51 separate attacks throughout the day, these numbers all coming from the regional administration in Sumy. These strikes came as Kyiv shot down all 4 Shahed drones used in Russia's overnight attacks on central Ukraine. Moving to Ukraine's effort to mobilise, Volodymyr Zelensky has signed a bill to lower the mobilisation age for combat duty from 27 to 25. This is in a move, of course, to help Ukraine generate more fighting power. The bill has been on the Ukrainian president's table since it was approved by lawmakers in May 2023. It expands the number of civilians the army can mobilise into its ranks to fight under full martial law, of course, which has been in place since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February 2022. The signing of the legislation was not immediately announced by the president's office. Parliament merely updated the entry for the bill on its website to read, "Return with the signature of the president of Ukraine." Zelensky had said last winter that he would only sign the bill if he was given a strong enough argument. And in December, he said that the military had proposed mobilizing up to 500,000 more Ukrainians into the armed forces, something for which the previous commander-in-chief had asked. Oleksandr Sursky, the new head of the Ukrainian armed forces, said last week that that figure was no longer up to date and that it had been significantly reduced after a review of resources. Zelensky also signed 2 other bills. One requires men given waivers from military service on disability grounds to have another medical assessment, and another will create an online database of people eligible for military service. Both of these bills could help the military draft more fighters. As we have been reporting, of course, the new law was mired in some controversy. A string of stricter measures set out in an earlier bill were cut after a public outcry, and we'll have you more details and analysis when we have it tomorrow. Let's move to Russia, where the Russian Defense Ministry has seen a major leap in the number of people joining the armed forces since last month's deadly attack on the concert hall near Moscow. Obviously, pinch of salt caveats to these claims, but here's what they said. They said that more than 100,000 recruits have signed up since the start of the year, including more than 16,000 in the past 10 days alone. Quote, during interviews conducted over the past week at selection points in Russian cities, most candidates indicated the desire to avenge those killed in the tragedy that occurred on March the 22nd in the Moscow region as the main motive for concluding a contract. To remind ourselves, the Kremlin has repeatedly sought to blame Ukraine for the mass shooting in which 144 people were killed at Krokus City Hall, a claim Kyiv and US intelligence have denied. The militant group Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. A few more updates from me. The Institute for the Study of War, that's the ISW, the US-based think tank, has said that Ukraine's drone attack on industrial facilities in Tatarstan, this is the attack Roland Oliphant was speaking about yesterday, marks a substantial turning point in Kiev's ability to conduct long-range strikes deep within Russian territory. They said, the distance of the targets from Ukraine's borders represents a significant inflection in Ukraine's demonstrated capability to conduct long-range strikes far into the Russian rear. Ukraine flew what is thought to be a light aircraft packed with explosives into a factory assembling drones in Russia's central Tatarstan region. This is from Ukrainian military intelligence, HUR, which lay, of course, 750 miles away from the Russia-Ukraine border. As Roland said yesterday, the strike is thought to be the deepest inside Russia since the start of the war. Finally, Ukraine's HUR military intelligence service has said that the destruction of the Kerch Bridge connection that's between mainland Russia to occupied Crimea is, quote, inevitable. Senior officials told the Guardian newspaper, we will do it in the first half of 2024, adding that Kirill Budanov, the head of the main directorate of intelligence, already had, quote, most of the means to carry out this goal. The officials apparently believe that permanently damaging the bridge would significantly impair the Kremlin's ability to carry out a spring offensive, as Moscow would be forced to transport military supplies by road through occupied southern Ukraine or via a new 450-mile railway line that's under construction. Ukraine has attacked and severely damaged the Kerch Bridge twice since the invasion, while road and rail traffic across it are frequently disrupted by the threat of further attacks. Those are all the military updates. Francis Sternley, what's been across your desk today?
Well, thanks, David. Some big developments in NATO in the past 24 hours, which are worth reflecting on in the context of the broader strategic picture. NATO could send weapons and ammunition to Ukraine for the first time under a plan to Trump-proof Western support for Kyiv. A $100 billion trust fund scheme would see the Transatlantic Military Alliance take charge of donations previously sent on an individual basis. That would likely require European NATO members to commit a greater proportion of money and weapons than they currently do, which officials believe will help placate Donald Trump. So Jens Stoltenberg, NATO's departing Secretary General, privately told member states a shift in the alliance's donations policy is needed to shield aid against the winds of political change. A tacit admission, I think it's fair to say, that American support is not guaranteed. Details of the plan are still under discussion, but officials expect Europe to agree to fund the majority of long-term aid packages. Under one plan, Germany would fund 16%, Britain 11% and France 10%, so a sort of lion's share, whereas the US would be asked to stump up around 16%. The Baltic countries, of course, have proposed that the money being channeled into Ukraine's war effort could be increased further if NATO countries commit to spending at least 0.25% of GDP on aid for Kyiv, something that Dom has talked about a lot in the past. It needs to be some sort of trust fund construction, but one where you all agree to do this based on a common funding distribution key. That's coming from a senior NATO diplomat. Now, Joe Barnes has written this up for The Telegraph. Under this scheme, NATO commanders would take over the reins of the Ukraine contact group as well, and that's of 50-plus allies coordinating weapons deliveries to Kyiv, which was previously managed, crucially, by the Americans. The challenge, of course, is that the spectre of fears around escalation still haunt some European capitals. In early discussions over the scheme, a number of allies have raised issues over the previously agreed red line to directly deliver lethal aid to Kyiv. Quote, if we are to do this, we have to cross the Rubicon, in that NATO will have a role in coordinating the supply of lethal support to Ukraine. That's what another senior diplomat said. The aim is to finalise the deal ahead of a crunch summit to mark NATO's 75th anniversary in July, just days before Trump's expected coordination as the Republican candidate for president. To further appease American unease about their support for Ukraine, Zelensky will be advised to accept this deal put forward, even though at this stage it contains no concrete promise of NATO membership for Kyiv. Interestingly, though, in the last hour or so, Jens Stoltenberg has said that Ukraine will become a member of NATO. It is a question of when, not if. Suffice to say, David, this is a considerable development and a further sign of shifting sands in the European context, which many, of course, will welcome. Of course, from the American perspective, it is a sign of its waning trustworthiness in the eyes of many Westerners. And in that vein, I want to draw attention to a long read by Frederick W. Kagan, who, of course, we spoke to on the podcast several months ago, along with Katerina Stepanenko and Natalia Bugiova of the Institute for the Study of War. It's called Denying Russia's Only Strategy for Success. It is a superb summary of the state of play, stressing that Russia cannot defeat Ukraine or the West and will likely lose if the West truly mobilizes its resources to resist the Kremlin. It also looks into how the Russian strategy that matters most as a consequence of that is not its warfighting strategy, but rather its strategy to cause us to see the world as Moscow wishes us to see it and make decisions in a Kremlin-generated alternative reality that will allow Russia to win in the real world, namely that Russia prevailing is inevitable, and that it is essential, therefore, that the West stays on the sidelines. Now, interestingly, the piece also highlights how Moscow is hijacking and substituting key concepts of Western debate about the war, such as notions of peace and defence, contributing to category errors about both here in the West. Starkly, it says outright that Moscow, in the Washington context, is winning its overarching strategy in the information space. But that's not to say that they aren't trying elsewhere, too. Politico has done a good piece looking into a Russian political influence campaign that's been uncovered in Europe in the last few days, with members of the European Parliament allegedly being paid by Moscow to interfere in the upcoming EU election. So this scandal broke when the Czech government last week sanctioned a news site called Voice of Europe, which Prague said was part of a pro-Russian influence operation. The Belgian Prime Minister then chimed in and said Russia had approached members of the European Parliament and paid them, quote, to promote Russian propaganda, presumably without them realising quite where the money was coming from. Well, we hope. But Politico has also written as well about the stark military picture, which of course plays into both of these points. While some argue that any significant changes to the battlefield are unlikely in 2024 for either side, others are keen to emphasise the risk of a Ukrainian frontline collapse this year, given its vulnerabilities. After all, Zelensky himself is saying that. He's saying that unless the stalled US aid package is approved soon, his forces will have to, quote, go back, retreat step by step in small steps, with some major cities at risk of falling. Then bear in mind, of course, he is trying to urge action, so he's unlikely to play down the risks. But Ukrainian officials who spoke to Politico in this piece on conditions of anonymity did stress that there really is a risk of the front lines collapsing wherever Russian generals do decide to focus their upcoming offensive. They also stress, and I think this is really vital to get through to many in European capitals, that the Western-supplied F-16 fighter jets due to arrive in Ukraine this summer are no longer relevant. That's their quote. Of course, a theme we've discussed on the podcast many times. To quote directly from an official that's cited anonymously in the piece, often we just don't get the weapon systems at the time we need them. They come when they're no longer relevant. Every weapon has its own right time. F-16s were needed in 2023. They won't be right, they won't be game changers in 2024. Instead, the officer said Ukraine now needs more traditional weapons and drones. Quote, we need howitzers and shells, hundreds of thousands of shells and rockets. Now, of course, work is being done on that score, but it is still the Baltic states who are really leading the charge for the West to do more. Of course, Macron has chimed in on this as well, but it's the Baltics that have remained consistent throughout. And on that note, I wanted to draw attention to a piece in our paper over the weekend by the Estonian, Latvian and Lithuanian ambassadors to the UK, offering their perspective after 20 years as NATO members. As they write, we joined the alliance when, for many, the geopolitical sky seemed almost cloudless. We did not see it that way. our warnings about the latent and growing threat from the East were too easily dismissed in some Allied capitals. We knew then, just as we know today, that only a collective defence can guarantee security in Europe. We lacked this in the 1930s and paid a heavy price, one that Ukrainians are paying now. The torments, deportation, torture, kidnap of children, cultural erasure that they experience under Russian occupation awaken our own darkest memories and fears. They go on. Alliance leaders at the Vilnius summit last year stated clearly that Ukraine's future is in NATO. We want that as soon as possible, for the sake of all countries in the Euro-Atlantic space. As a battle-hardened ally, Ukraine will be a heavyweight contributor to our security. A clear path for Ukrainian membership must, therefore, be a priority for the alliance's 75th anniversary summit in Washington this summer. So that is the big ask from Baltic nations, it seems. If this is something that will be a collective position put forward in other opinion pieces around Europe, they are urging for there to be no equivocation on this idea of Ukraine formally being in the Western orbit in an institutional sense and specifically in the NATO context. It is regrettable, of course, that the Baltic nations' warnings went unheeded for so long and frankly still are arguably going unheeded. The Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas formally withdrew her candidacy to become the next NATO Secretary General last week, making it almost certain that the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte will be elected instead. The rumour is that, like last year, the feeling within the alliance remains that Kallas is simply too hawkish on Russia versus Rutte, who is more predictable and malleable on the issue when there may well be sensitive discussions around concessions, etc., etc. If true, that speaks to an institutional cautiousness which remains very, very hard to shake off, though it does seem, and I don't think it's overstating the case here, that the ground is slowly shifting, as I say. I should add, David, just to wrap up, that we'll add a link to all of those pieces in the show notes to the episode. A lot going on.
Thank you very much, Francis Sternley. James Kilner, foreign correspondent James Kilner, thank you so much for joining us. Can we come to you? There's a couple of pieces that you've been writing up for The Telegraph I think are important to speak through. Would you first of all talk about this piece you wrote up on how the Ukrainians are using machine gun units mounted on pickup trucks to shoot down Russian drones? And what does that tell us about the equipment shortage, the shell shortage?
Hi, David. Great to be back on the podcast. Apologies if you can hear some drilling in the background. They're doing something above me. And it's just started, so bad luck on the timing. On this, on the story you just referenced, the mobile machine gun units, that was really a story I just picked up off opposition, Russian opposition media, which were quoting sources in Ukraine saying that their weapon supplies had gotten so low now that they were basically having to ration the air defense missiles, targeting 1 in 6 missiles and trying to shoot down the drones with these mobile machine gun units. It's effectively a machine gun unit mounted on a pickup truck or 4x4 car, which races to the sighting of a drone and tries to shoot it down. You have to remember, with these drones, they do move very slowly, relative to missiles, which are moving the speed of sound. So they are, you can shoot them down with a machine gun. They are very deadly, though, as we know. When I was about a week or 10 days after I was in Odessa last month, a drone landed on a residential building very sadly and killed, I think, 15 people. So very serious threat, and another indication of just how short Ukraine is on ammunition.
And on that, James, when because this isn't necessarily new, the Ukrainians, you know, mounting machine guns and shooting down the slow-moving drones. But before the story, the emphasis in the story was on the innovation and on the sort of the ability to find simple, easy fixes to problems. It's interesting now that this story has been turned around and it's seen as evidence of a shortage and of the decline of Ukraine's ability to defend itself against drones and missiles. What do you make of that?
Well, I think they're having to improvise. I think it's a matter of needs must thing. So your colleagues in the newspaper, Joe Barnes and others, have written extensively about how Ukraine has manipulated civilian drones to take on Russia, is building fake armaments to try and confuse the Russians, has obviously developed to now world-class maritime drone units, etc. And it's just a matter of having to improvise. They don't have the big kit anymore. So they're having to take out these deadly slow-moving Shahed drones, Iran-manufactured drones, with machine guns, which is an incredible sort of... The optics are quite incredible in this day and age. They're having to shoot these drones out of the air with bullets rather than jamming equipment or a small missile.
Well, as you said, James, the news has just come in on our live blog. Ukraine's drone attack on industrial facilities in Tatarstan did not use weapons provided by Western allies. This is from Kyiv's military intelligence. Quote from Andrei Yusov, we can state that foreign-made weapons and equipment of our allies were not used in these events. The fact that the Ukrainian UAV industry is developing dynamically should not be concealed. James, let's move to your other story then. Tell us about Alla Pugacheva.
Yeah, the Pugacheva is an interesting story. Just to finish off on that drone segment of yours, David, which is really, really interesting that Ukraine can now hit Tatarstan, which is a long way from Ukraine, is actually ironically going to be the centre of Russia's new drone factory. The irony of Ukraine hitting Tatarstan is that is going to be the site of the Kremlin's massive drone factory. They've licensed these Iranian drones and that's where they're going to build them. And also, listeners have to remember that the Ukrainian drone attacks have been very savvy, targeting these oil refineries around the country. I was reading, I think on Friday or Saturday, that oil prices have risen in Russia by about 14% since the Ukrainians started attacking these refineries. So really interesting stuff going on around there. Not only has Ukraine been successful targeting the Black Sea Fleet, but also these oil refineries undermining the Kremlin and hurting ordinary people. Swiftly moving on to Pugacheva. So yeah, interesting story again, David. Alla Pugacheva's often referred to as one of the most famous pop stars in Russia. I think she's 74, so she started her career in the Soviet Union, has been dubbed the Queen of Soviet Pop, etc. Sold millions and millions of records in Russia and formerly the Soviet Union. All families will know her sort of uplifting ditty songs. But she won various artists, awards for her artistry from the Kremlin, including from Putin. There's a quite a well-known photo going around of Putin shaking Pugacheva's hands in the Kremlin. But she was a very early outspoken critic of this war in Ukraine. And she left Russia in 2022 with her husband, who is a Russian TV host, quite well known in his own right. And they went to Israel. And I think since the war in Gaza started, they have now left Israel and moved to a summer house, a villa in Cyprus, I think. But she seemed... So the Kremlin has these so-called Z influencers, and they're like these attack dogs which they let loose on people they don't think are being hardcore enough in their sort of support for the war. And they have seemingly picked on Pugacheva since the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack at the end of last month. Now, her error seems to have been supporting or putting out a sort of a sympathetic social media post aimed at a ethnic Tajik singer, who was worrying about the plight of her fellow countrymen in Russia, and indeed the torture that the alleged gunmen were inflicted on the alleged gunmen when they were in Russian custody. So Pugacheva put out a sympathetic tweet about this or Instagram message. And since then, it was after that that she really came into fire from these so-called Z influencers, who now have got the Russian prosecutors on side, lining her up to be potentially labelled as a foreign agent. The foreign agent is a Soviet-era title which people are labelled with, which essentially means they're sort of a low-level enemy of the state, and they find it hard. If you're a foreign agent, you sort of find it hard to do banking properly, buy property, move around the country, this sort of thing. So the Kremlin is going after Pugacheva, one of the most famous pop stars in Russian history. And it's going to be very interesting to see where they go through this. Some high profile Russian influencers have already said they think this might be a step too far from the Kremlin, but the Kremlin's incredibly unpredictable. And yeah, we'll just have to wait and see how far they go on that one, David.
Thank you very much, James, for joining us. We'll come back to you, of course, for your final thoughts at the end of the episode. Well, thank you so much to Natasha Hartman and Jeffrey Hartman for joining us from Ukrainian Action. Natasha, would you like to start? Can you just introduce your group? Tell us a bit about how you started.
Thank you very much for having us on the podcast today. So I was born in Odessa, and I grew up in Melbourne, Australia, and spent the last 15 years living and working in London, where I met my husband, Jeff, about 13 years ago. And Jeff is American, and our connection to Ukraine at the time that we met was anecdotal, I would say, and really coincidental. He served in the US Peace Corps as a teacher in Western Ukraine in the early 2000s. And so we met, and he worked in energy, and I worked in financial services, and we lived our lives in London. And then it wasn't really until the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 22 that this feeling of identity of what it means to be a Ukrainian became really very strong. And on top of that, this feeling of this sense of the real injustice of what was happening. And first, we were paralyzed and shocked, like a lot of the rest of the world. And then we started donating to well-known charities and sharing information with our networks about how to help Ukraine. But it didn't feel like enough. And then one day, Jeff said to me, "Natasha, I know what we're going to do to help Ukraine. We're going to buy a pickup truck for my friends and former students." And so we bought two vehicles with the support of our personal networks. And in early March 22, Jeff and our friend Matthew Morgan, who is the third co-founder of Ukrainian Action, drove these two vehicles filled with aid from London to the Ukrainian border. And that is where the story of Ukrainian Action started. Since then, we have sent 265 vehicles to Ukraine, over 52 convoys. Many of these vehicles are used for medical evacuations and distribution of humanitarian aid. Somehow, we have rallied 300 volunteer drivers, and we have a core operational support team of 40 people across the UK, Poland, the US, and Ukraine. And in February of this year, we started a rehabilitation program for Ukrainian veterans in the Carpathians.
Well, let's move on to that program in the Carpathians then. Can you tell us a little bit about why you started this, what actually is involved in it, and some of the stories of the people that you're helping?
Well, thanks, David. We call the program Ukrainian Action Heroes. It's a two-week program based in Ukraine's Carpathian Mountains. The idea is that we're treating Ukrainian war veterans who suffer from PTSD by teaching them to ski and to snowboard alongside psychological support such as group therapy and mindfulness activities such as meditation, yoga, traditional Ukrainian sauna, and cold plunge. Skiing is an outdoor sport that requires balance and concentration, which means that participants must be present. There's no time to think about the past or the future when you're skiing. You must live in the moment. Skiing enables you to feel free and to clear your mind. Actually, I was inspired to start such a program by my personal friends in Ukraine who fought in the war and then had difficulties reintegrating into society. Many went right back to work only days after serving in trenches, which is incredibly difficult. For most of us, it's difficult to transition back after a bank holiday weekend. And these guys were spending time under fire in trenches in difficult. One friend of mine named Taras was a professional snowboarder in Ukraine who actually volunteered to fight. He spent 9 months on the front, and then he returned to the mountains after having a bad experience on the front in order to heal. And that inspired our program. We actually shot a documentary film about Taras alongside U.S. ski movie company Matchstick Productions, which will be premiering at the Five Points Film Festival in Colorado, USA, later this month. And we hope the film will also premiere in the U.K. and will provide people with insight into the difficulties, not only for average people who are fighting in this war, but for the challenges of reintegrating into society after such a battle.
Thank you so much for that explanation there. Could you tell us a little bit about what you learnt about their experiences? What surprised you about some of the stories you heard?
Well, what's amazing is that these are really normal guys that we are inviting into our program. 2 years ago, they were farmers, they were entrepreneurs, they were students. They were men who volunteered to defend their cities, which were under attack. Almost all of our guys have PTSD and physical injuries. Most have never skied before or even been to the mountains. Our first group of Ukrainian Action Heroes welcomed 7 men from the Kherson region in southern Ukraine. Again, these are normal guys who volunteered to defend their city, which was occupied and then liberated. 2 of our guys were held in Russian captivity and exchanged in prisoner swaps. I mean, these guys have gone through a horrible amount of suffering, but they came to our program and they learned to ski. They're skiing, they're smiling, and they're relaxing. And these guys would say things to me like, "This is the first time in 2 years I haven't heard explosions on a daily basis. This is the first time in 2 years I've been able to relax." Other of our heroes came from Kyiv, from Kharkiv, from Zaporizhia. Many of them were involved in key battles that we heard about in Hostomel, Bucha, Irpin. Many fought in Bakhmut. But just to give you an idea, I mean, one guy came, he had over 30 holes in his body from shrapnel wounds. He'd never skied before. But after 1 week, he was skiing fast, he had a smile on his face, and we couldn't get him off the mountain, and he couldn't wait to come back. The last guy I'll tell you about was actually 60 years old. He had 3 kids, which means in Ukraine, if you have 3 children, you're not obligated to fight, but he did anyway. He volunteered to fight, and he was going back to his old job after our program, and he was incredibly thankful for the opportunity to come and to recover before reintegrating back to his civilian life.
Thank you both very much for coming in today. It's fascinating hearing about your work. Natasha, can I ask a little bit more about the numbers here are extraordinary, 260 vehicles, that's a lot. I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about the process of getting that number. Quite often when we speak to charities, they're doing amazing work, but they're talking about smaller numbers. So I'm interested in the upscaling process and the challenges involved in that, as well as perhaps a little bit more about the supporters you have. I know you do something about corporate convoys as well. I'm interested to hear more.
Thanks, Francis. Yeah, we've been very pleasantly surprised and encouraged by the support that we've received. The first 9 weeks, so after that first trip in early March, Jeff drove 9 weeks in a row on weekends in convoys, and every time he drove, he would drive with new people. So we constantly had people contacting us, hearing through friends, through word of mouth about what we were doing. And we were able in that way to raise money to be able to purchase trucks, but also people were spreading the word with their networks. And so with each trip, we would have new volunteer drivers. We now go once every 2 weeks instead of every week. And we have been very fortunate to have the support of a few companies that has allowed us to scale up in this way. And so the way that a company might support us is they select anywhere from 5 to 15 employees, and they would send them on a team building weekend with us. So they would join our convoys driving vehicles from the UK to Poland. We have another team that then takes the vehicles to the border, and then another team that takes them from the border into Ukraine. The employees would fundraise, and then the company matches the fundraising, and in some cases has also sponsored part or the entire convoy, making a donation which allows us to purchase the vehicles driven by team members. So it's a great bonding experience for the team. It's very organized in that we provide the team leader, we provide the vehicles, we provide the structure, and it's a very tangible way for employees to be able to really make a difference. They are packing the trucks with supplies. They are physically driving them and delivering them. In other cases, companies have chosen Ukrainian Action as their charity partner for corporate challenges. So, for example, a hike, or one company cycled from London to Paris on behalf of Ukrainian Action, which was just incredible. And in other cases, companies have donated physical items. So, for example, old devices or laptops which were being retired that we were able to give to IDPs, displaced children in Ukraine that were wanting to study remotely. A clothing retailer in Poland donated pallets of children's clothing and stationery. Now, it was incredible when they first gave me a box, and then they saw that we delivered the box, and then they gave me 3 pallets, and then the next it was 33 pallets, and we thought, okay, we're going to need a lorry for this. This is not going to fit on the back of a pickup truck. But we were able to deliver that to orphanages across Ukraine. And then a pharmaceuticals company donated a pallet of wound dressings that we delivered to a hospital in Ukraine. Additionally, we've had people in local communities and individuals volunteer. We have an absolutely incredible group of supporters based in Devon that have rallied together and put on all sorts of local fundraising events, dances. They even walked on behalf of Ukrainian Action in their local carnival, and they purchased trucks. They organized their own convoys using our infrastructure and our network. And it really shows that people across all of England are standing behind Ukraine. We're extremely grateful to all of the individual people that have donated and supported us and volunteered, and all of our corporate supporters, because every little action that somebody takes and piece of help allows us to help where it's needed in Ukraine.
We often hear this term banded around of war fatigue, but given the upscaling that you've undergone in the past few months particularly, that doesn't seem to be the case. But can you just talk a little bit about the challenges that you find? Do you see that there is an interest in waning? Is it harder to get support, or is there actually still enormous interest in this that means that it makes it much not easier as such, but that people perhaps have woken up to what is really at stake in Ukraine?
We've read those headlines, but in terms of our day-to-day, we've been very pleasantly surprised that we've not seen much of a decrease in interest to donate to ourselves or to volunteer with ourselves. Which is great, because every day we're receiving more requests from Ukraine through our personal friends, through our trusted network. And we're very grateful for those donors and those volunteers who continue to support us, because it enables us to go out to procure the vehicles and the supplies that are needed and to continue our operation, which is one of really direct support. We're hand-delivering everything that we procure to the final beneficiary in Ukraine through our network. So we're grateful that we have not seen interest to support Ukraine wane at all, especially in the UK.
That's very encouraging. And just speaking, I was alluding there, I suppose, to the challenges. I want to move it one step further, which is the sort of the threat. I've heard stories of sometimes vehicles being vandalized, not relating to your charity, but others who are doing similar work. Are you aware of this? And I'm interested in other things that it's not easy given the current situation. And it's also, just the challenge of logistically driving that distance. So any thoughts you have on either of those subjects would be interesting.
We've had challenges. There's no doubt about that. Fortunately, most of our challenges have been mechanical. The odd breakdown in Belgium or France along the road. We have had attacks on our social media sites from most likely Russian bots and the like, but we haven't seen anything vandalized. We've only been welcomed with open arms, especially in places like Poland and obviously in Ukraine as well. We recognize that we're in this for the long haul. We've been at it for 2 years. We're going to be at it for as many more years as it takes. And we expect there will be challenges. But I think our mindset is one of problem solving. We're not going to get too focused on complaining about problems. We're just going to keep moving ahead and deal with them and keep building the organization and keep doing everything that we can to capture resources in the UK and get them to people who need them in Ukraine.
Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey and Natasha, for talking us through all of that. Coming up, we hear Francis James and our guests' final thoughts.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Let's move now to our final thoughts. James Kilner, would you like to go first?
Thank you, David. So really quickly, 3 points to leave your listeners. One specific on Russia, and two from the wider South Caucasus, Central Asia area, which I know your listeners are interested in the context of the war. The first one is that, as you said at the beginning of the programme, Russia is now claiming that 16,000 men have signed up to fight in the army in the last 10 days, motivated apparently by the Crocus Hall attacks. Now, this is important because, as we know, the Kremlin's worked very hard to pin the blame on Ukraine. It says, yes, fair enough, ISIS-K was involved, but actually it was all organized by Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. Today in Astana, Nikolai Patrushev, the Kremlin security chief, has been talking to allies in something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a Russia-China project based around Central Asia. And he has been ramming home that message again. He once again said Ukraine was behind these attacks. So I think we're going to see more of this going forward, David. They're still hammering on about how Ukraine was behind this heinous attack in March. Obviously, the West and the US and Ukraine have utterly denied this, but it's definitely been used as a mobilization tool, and it comes as Ukraine itself struggles to recruit more soldiers and to get arms. So it's a very dangerous situation there. The second one is Kyrgyzstan, where earlier this week the president signed into law something called the Foreign Agents Bill, which is a Kremlin-inspired bill, which means that all NGOs and media that receive funding from abroad need to register in a government list. It essentially makes it easier for the government to close down irksome media and NGO projects. This has been heavily criticised by the likes of Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and Western embassies, etc., etc. The importance here in the context of your programme, Ukraine, the latest in the war, is that the Kremlin still has a lot of cachet around the world. Kyrgyzstan is basically mimicking the Kremlin on this one and is taking their lead and is implementing very, very similar laws. This is a slap in the face to the West, which we know, we've spoken about at length, has been trying to woo Central Asia away from the Kremlin's orbit in the last 2 years since the invasion of Ukraine. So really interesting little nuance going over Central Asia for your listeners to be aware of. And then finally, Nikol Pashinyan, the under pressure Prime Minister of Armenia, he's flying to Brussels tomorrow, or maybe later tonight. But anyway, he's meeting tomorrow in Brussels, Blinken, the US Secretary of State, and von der Leyen, the European Commission President. We don't 100% know what they're going to talk about, but this is important because in the last couple of weeks, Armenia has been making more and more noise about joining the EU, which is an absolute red rag to the Kremlin. The Kremlin is already saying this is a huge error. Armenia has been tricked into joining some sort of Western alliance, et cetera, et cetera. We know that Armenia has been, as Roland was talking about on your other podcast, Battle Lines, Armenia has been very upset with Moscow failing to protect against Azerbaijani aggression last year. There's lots of rumblings on the border again. For my money, this conflict, this sort of low-intensity conflict in the South Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Armenia, is being conflated massively by the war in Ukraine. Alliances have been hardened. If there is more fighting, if the Kremlin pushes Azerbaijan or sort of approves an Azerbaijan push to reclaim more land from Armenia, we could see a very serious escalation down there, with the West being pulled into yet another conflict area with the likes of Russia again and Turkey. So something really interesting to watch out for tomorrow coming out of Brussels, David.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, James. And just a reminder to our listeners that my interview with Roland Oliphant, our senior foreign correspondent that James referenced there, is on our sister podcast, Battle Lines. I do believe it's the most recent episode, so do go and download that and have a listen. I think it's the third item in the list of things we talk about, and it's Roland explaining what's happening on the border between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Francis Sternley, can I come to you next?
Well, thanks, David. And just to add something to what James was saying there, I think the other region, of course, that we have talked about in the podcast in the last few months, but is particularly febrile at the moment and like to do some analysis on it soon, is the Balkans as well, somewhere which is not being perhaps focused on to the degree that it should be. And it was very striking, I think, the remarks coming out of the Kosovan Prime Minister with Daniel Sheridan in an interview which I referenced, I think it was early last week. So just another region for us to all be keeping a close eye on, because of course Moscow wants to sow discord there, because anything that can alleviate pressure on the Ukraine battlefield will be of great assistance to them. And of course, if NATO has its eye there, it may well be not prioritising what Kyiv needs. I also just want to thank listeners who wrote in regarding potential changes in the US picture over the coming months, with some speculating that due to machinations over there, the slim majority the Republicans wield over the House of Representatives could disappear before November, offering opportunities for Ukraine. The trigger, specifically, would be that members who plan to retire next January are ditching Capitol Hill early. If their seats remain vacant for a period, that would mean the Democrats could, in effect, seize control of the House in between elections, because it would be more Republicans who are stepping down due to tensions in the party than Democrats. Now, to stress, that's never happened before in history where there'd be such a switch. But it is being openly discussed, including by Republican sympathising outlets like Fox, who fear its implications. So just something else for us to monitor. But as I say, thank you very much to those listeners who've reached out on this specific point. We will be paying close attention to it.
Well, thank you very much, James and Francis. Jeffrey and Natasha, can we come to you very quickly for a brief final thought?
So, yes, we have a black tie dinner on the 20th of April at the Royal Automobile Club in London. And that'll be a dinner, drinks and an auction. And the purpose of the evening is really, number one, to continue to keep awareness high on the situation in Ukraine and to make sure that fatigue is not a thing, and that people understand what is happening and why the West needs to get behind Ukraine. And then the second goal of that evening is to raise money for our continued delivery of aid to Ukraine, as well as in particular for the rehabilitation program. The program that we mentioned today was a pilot. So we had three groups in a winter program learn to ski and snowboard. We would love to be able to extend that into a year-long program. There are many things that you can do in the mountains year long that will be beneficial to rehabilitation. And so we have some very interesting speakers, Francis being one of them. So Francis is hosting a panel of experts. We have author and activist Bill Browder. If you haven't read his books, Red Notice or Freezing Order, I highly recommend them. Bill managed a hedge fund trading Russian stocks in Russia in the 90s and 2000s. He exposed Russian corruption and was ruthlessly pursued by the Russian state, with some shocking and devastating consequences. And I'll leave it there because the book is fascinating and shocking. We also have Eduard Fesco, acting Ukrainian ambassador to the UK, speaking on the panel. And we have Jack Lopresti, who is an MP and deputy chair of the Conservative Party. And Jack has a particular interest in the armed forces and veterans programs. And so all of our participants will be sharing their views on the current situation in Ukraine. We also have a musical performance by Oleg Skripka and his band Vopliviu de Plyasova, who are absolute rock legends in Ukraine. They were one of the first rock bands to sing rock music in Ukrainian. They perform on the front lines. In fact, one of their band members is serving at the moment. And so they, excluding the serving band member, are coming from Ukraine to perform for our audience. And our audience is a mix of people across the finance, technology, real estate, and insurance sectors in the UK. We also have some volunteer drivers attending and visiting from the US to join. We still have some seats left, and so we would welcome Telegraph listeners, and we would welcome supporters of Ukraine on the evening.
Thank you, David. The concept of fatigue was mentioned earlier, so I'd just like to talk a little bit about the heroics of average people in Ukraine. The difficulty of life there for everyone, average citizens, for soldiers, really should not be underestimated. Russian attacks on cities might be getting less attention in the media, but in many cities, there are daily air raid sirens and regular shelling on civilians. And you can't imagine the stress that that creates. You know, we read that 99% of these attacks are destroyed by Ukraine's air defense systems. But every parent, every night, is scared for their children when there are attacks. Russian attacks on cities in Ukraine really amount to a systematic torture of civilians. Citizens are being tortured with sleep deprivation, with stress. Families have been split up by the war. Women and children are living abroad. Men are forced to stay behind and fight. This creates severe stress and potentially long-term demographic challenges for Ukraine. And again, most of these soldiers were just regular guys 2 years ago. Every Ukrainian's life is plagued with uncertainty. Everyone tells me there that they can't plan anything. Ukrainians, the nation, 45 million people living in Europe, they don't know what their future holds. And yet Ukraine won't give up. They need all the help it can get. Ukraine fatigue in the West is completely unjustified, but in Ukraine it's very real, and that's precisely why they need our help. This war will not last forever, so we must do all we can now. And in closing, I'd just like to implore all the listeners to take action to support Ukraine. Volunteer, donate, inform your colleagues, your friends, your kids about the injustices that are happening there to raise awareness. If you'd like to donate or volunteer to Ukrainian Action, you can go through our website, ukrainianaction.com. And if you'd like to attend our fundraiser, where Francis will be hosting the panel, please email events@ukrainianaction.com. Thank you very much for having us.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And, if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.